Pippi Audio.
Meillä on vieraana Hannu Reime, joka on kirjoitti tässä jo muutama vuosi sitten kirjan Israel-Palestiina, joka tuli pystykorvana Liken kustantamana. Ja meillä on vieraana myös Laila El-Hadad, joka on palestiinalainen toimittaja.
I'm a Palestinian, I'm from Gaza. And I grew up in the Gulf states with my parents, with many thousands of others Palestinians. Kuwait,
Saudi Arabia. Leila on 32-vuotias, hänellä on kaksi lasta ja hän on palestiinalainen syntyjä. Hän kasvoi tuolla Persianlahden which country were you?
I was born in Kuwait and then I was a little bit in Saudi Arabia, a little bit in Bahrain.
Hän syntyi Kuwaitissa, oli asui jonkin aikaa Saudi-Arabiassa ja Bahrainissa.
But all throughout my childhood we would kind of go back and forth to Gaza. And returning there and renewing our identity papers, because our documents were all Palestinian, was an integral part of my upbringing. And, enforcing my Palestinian identity was very important to my parents, especially my mother. If we didn't go back every year to renew our documents, there was an Israeli policy that said if you didn't go back every year, they would take those documents from you and you would no longer have a right to reside or live in your own country in Palestine.
Leila kasvoi tällaisessa aika erikoisessa olosuhteessa. Siinä mielessä hän joutui vaihtamaan tai kerran vuodessa käymään kotimaassaan Palestiinassa Gaasassa ja uusimaan tällaisen matkustusasiakirjan, jonka perusteella hän kävi tuolla. Jos hän ei olisi käynyt kerran vuodessa Gaasassa, niin Israel olisi ottanut häntä pois tämän matkustusdokumentin ja hän ei olisi voinut enää käydä. Hän olisi tullut niin kuin jäänyt kotimaassa ulkopuolelle kokonaan.
So my identity and many other Palestinians was formed around displacement and around borders. This is how our identity became, it was central to our identity. Edward Said has talked extensively about this, the late Palestinian.
Ja hän kertoo siitä, että hänen identiteettinsä muodostui tästä pakolaisuudesta ja siitä siirtymisestä maasta toiseen. Ja samanlainen sen kokemus, joka oli tällä kuuluisella palestinalaisella kirjailijalla Edward Saidilla, joka kuoli muutama vuosi sitten, joka oli palestinalaisten tänne tunnettu puhemies.
So now going to the modern. And then I completed my education in the United States and my master's. And after I finished, I went back to Gaza and I began to work there as a journalist for several years. And during the process, I got married and my husband is actually a Palestinian refugee. He was raised in a camp in Lebanon, and because he's a Palestinian refugee, his parents are from the northern historic Palestine, from Haifa, he's not allowed to return to his homeland. He can't even visit. He's not issued a family reunion permit. So even though we're married, he can't come with me to Gaza, even after the disengagement, even after Israel supposedly
Where's your husband living?
So now he's in the United States. He's a physician, but he still has a refugee permit. We're not U.S. citizens.
Joo, Leila opiskeli Yhdysvalloissa ja valmistui siellä ja sitten palasi sen jälkeen Gaasaan toimittajaksi. Ja hänen miehensä on palestinalainen pakolainen, joka on kotoisin Haifasta, siis nykyistä Israelin, pohjoista Israelin kaupungista. Ja hänen perheensä pakeni Libanoniin ja hänen aviomiehensä ei voi mennä Palestinan alueelle, vaan hänen pitää pysyä. Hän asuu tällä hetkellä Yhdysvalloissa.
And then around 2004, I was visiting him in the U.S., going back to Gaza. And during that process, the border to Gaza was closed by Israel for an extensive period, as it has been. It's been a continuous policy to always close the border on and off. We now hear of the closure on Gaza, but it's always been, at some degree closed. And so we had to stay. My son was about 9 months in Egypt for a long period of time. And at that point, I created my blog. And initially, it was just kind of to document raising my son so that my husband can keep in touch with us because we were apart for a long period, but it evolved into something more. It was kind of my realization of how the personal is political for Palestinians, and the blog started from there, documenting the personal and political for Palestinians.
So that started in 2004?
Yeah. In December 2004, yeah.
Yeah. Hän kertoi siitä, että tämä raja tuli yhä suljetummaksi vuonna 2004 ja hänen toinen 9 kuukautta vanha lapsensa asui Egyptissä ja hänen miehensä oli hyvin vaikea tällainen perheen keskeinen kontakti juuri tämän takia, että raja erotti heidät toisistaan.
Yeah, and I continued, to write my blog. It became, you know, more. Yeah.
Ja tässä vaiheessa hän alkoi kirjoittaa blogiaan, joka on sitten, joka on hyvin luettu tällä hetkellä.
Yeah, and the main period I was there was covering the from 2003 to about 2007, covering the disengagement, the elections, all of that period, the period of lawlessness leading up to the infighting and the so-called, you know, coup and the CIA plot to kind of overthrow Hamas. And since 2007, I haven't been able to go back. I've been denied entry on one hand by Israel, the other hand by Egypt. So the last time I tried last year, I was detained by Egypt and then I was deported back to the U.S.
So since 2007 you have gone...
The last time I was able to physically, you know, be in Gaza was 2007, yeah.
Jo tällä hetkellä Gaza on kokonaan suljettu leila, että hän on viimeksi käynyt siellä vuonna 2007. Ja tuota, siellä oli siinä vaiheessa hyvin levoton sisäinen tilanne myöskin, koska siellä tapahtuu tästä sisäistä. Se oli tilanne, jossa tuota, se oli sen ikään kuin Hamas voitti. It was after the election which Hamas...
No, I went after the it was right around, you know, June 2007 was like the so what they call the takeover after Hamas had won the elections and there was
in January when they
no, it was June 2007.
Yeah, but
January 2006 was the elections. Yeah.
Ja silloin oli vaalit vuonna 2007, jotka Hamas voitti ja joka johti sitten siihen, että Hamasin kohdistui ulkopuolelta valtava painostusta ja siellä vaikutti, because CIA was part of that.
Was funding the plot. Yeah, it was there was a big article called the Gaza Bombshell and it exposed the whole plot. They were funded like the Mohammed Dahlan and his forces like $84 million to, you know, create anarchy in Gaza and then overthrow the government.
Se oli tällainen osa tästä Palestiinan hallinnon tällaista turvallisuusjoukosta niin yritti syrjäyttää Hamasin täällä Gazassa kesällä 2007 ja siellä oli seurauksena sitten, että Hamas otti hallintansa koko tämän Gazan alueen ja sen jälkeen se on ollut Hamasin hallinnassa.
Anything else?
So how do you cover the events in Gaza nowadays?
Nowadays I you know, when I was there I was writing for several media outlets. I was writing for Al Jazeera English at the time, the online version, and the BBC and the Guardian. Now I rely more on freelancing, my blog. I still contribute to Al Jazeera, but I'm writing a book based on my experiences.
Yeah. Where are you based nowadays?
Now I'm based in Maryland, near Washington, D.C.
In Berlin and in Washington, D.C.
Near Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And I maintain a very intimate connection to Gaza as much as I can. I write about it based on my parents were there during the attacks on Gaza, and so I was maintaining very close contact with them and all of my family, and I continued to blog and write about Gaza and the way it affects, you know, Palestinians everywhere and Gazans everywhere, because it's like I said, it's a very personal and intimate issue. It doesn't just affect Palestinians, you know.
Joo. Hän on pysyvästi tällä hetkellä Washingtonin lähellä Yhdysvalloissa, ja hän seuraa sieltä tapahtumia Gazassa ja pitää blogiaan ja hän ei tietysti voi toimia sillä tavalla kirjeenvaihtaja niin kuin aikaisemmin siellä. Now I think that can you tell something about the situation after the attack of in 2008-2009 during this past 1 year and a half.
Yeah, since the
since
like
the attack.
Led?
Yes.
Yeah, since that period.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I always say usually after there's some kind of major attack or people call it a war, of course it wasn't a war because that implies there was symmetry, but there wasn't symmetry. There's usually some kind of relief for the people, you know, when you look at historically speaking. But in the case of Gaza, there was no relief. Things just got worse and the closure was tightened even more. And, you know, and it's you have to look at it, the Israeli policy in a larger context, because it's something that's been continuous, you know, since day one, even before, you know, since the Oslo Accords and continuing on. So the closure of Gaza really started, you know, obviously way back. But if you look at the early 90s, after the Oslo Accords, that's when they officially put the border crossings around Gaza. And it's just gotten, you know, tighter and tighter since then. So if you're talking specifically since the attacks on Gaza, the closure continues, so there's still a hermetic closure of Gaza. There's still an aerial blockade. You know, the airport in Gaza was destroyed. We haven't been able to use it since 2000. There's a land blockade. Egypt, on one hand, closes the Rafah crossing, and then on the other side, Israel closes. And then there's a naval blockade. And so Gaza is completely sealed off, and it's probably the only territory, and we have to remember it's not a state, you know, it's still an occupied territory. In the whole world in modern history that's faced the situation where it's still occupied, it's largely consists of refugees who are from neighboring villages just outside the Gaza Strip, you know, dating from 1948. And on top of that, they're subject to a methodical siege, meaning it's something that it's not, it was not by coincidence that it happened. It was very, people thought about it, governments plotted it, they planned it, and it's sustained. And even after the attacks on Gaza, you know, and all their horror, the siege continues and the closure continues. And, you know, the opposition to the Israeli policies is not really there on a governmental level at least. So
yes. Leila kertoo siitä, että Gaza on tällä hetkellä oikeastaan ainut paikka maailmassa, joka on täysin eristetty, siis sotilaisesti eristetty. Se on, Israel sulkee sen rajat ja Egypti sulkee tässä Rafahin ylistyskohdalla rajat. Se on, sen ilmatilaa valvotaan ja sen koko rannikko on suljettu. Että se, ja tämä tilanne on jatkunut oikeastaan sitä Oslon rauhan sopimus, so-called peace agreement, as you call this peace process in Oslo, and since then it, sitä, että tämä tilanne meni, muuttui pahemmaksi tämän rauhanprosessin aikana, jolloin, jolloin tämä Gaza, tämä eristys on jatkunut oikeastaan 90-luvun alkupuolelta lähtien jo, ja se on vielä pahentunut tämän 1,5 vuotta sitten käydyn. Hän ei kutsu sitä sodaksi tätä Israelin hyökkäystä, koska siinä oli niin vahva epäsymmetria, että oli Israelin armeija ja sitten olivat gaasalaiset siellä. Että tilanne on mennyt koko ajan vain huonommaksi, ja varsinkin juuri tämän vielä tämän 1,5 vuoden aikana.
And you know, it's on Oslo, it's important to mention that Oslo, what it really did in the minds of most Palestinians is it institutionalized the occupation, it formalized it, and it created a quasi-government, a Palestinian authority that became the subcontractors of the occupation. And when any government that was in charge in the PA, whether at the end of his time, whether it was Arafat or Abbas or Hamas, if anyone deviated from this script of being the subcontractor, then they were immediately punished. So forget about Hamas. Everyone goes, Hamas and terror. You know, look back to 2000 when Arafat was in charge. They did the same thing. The Israel isolated him when he refused the Camp David Accords. You know, they began to attack him and they called him a terrorist. So if any government in the Palestinian Authority deviates from the script of being the subcontractor of the occupation with no sight for Palestinian statehood, not a real hope, then immediately they're punished, you know, they're ostracized and they're called terrorists.
Joo, Leila kertoo siitä, että tämä rauhanprosessi johti siihen, että tämä tavallaan institutionalisoitiin, tehtiin pysyväksi tämä miehitys. Ja Israel lähti, Israelin motiivina oli siinä se, että palestinalaista tehtiin tällaisia Israelin alihankkijoita. Eli niin kuin, kind of a colonial police.
What?
Kind of a colonial police,
yes,
of Israel.
Exactly, yeah.
Jonkinlaisia
yeah.
Niin kuin Israelin siirtomaapoliiseja. Ja kysymys ei ole Hamasista siitä, että islamistinen Hamas on tällä hetkellä Gazassa vallassa, vaan sama toteutui myöskin Arafatin eläessä ja PLOlle. Ja heti jos niin kuin palestinaiset poikkesi tästä käsikirjoitusta, jonka Israel oli valmistellut, niin heti silloin niin kuin siihen vastattiin sotilaallisesti. Ja tämä tilanne on jatkunut. Toisaalta tilanne paheni tämän rauhanprosessin aikana huomattavasti aikaisemmasta.
Yeah, and few people realize there's no mention of Palestinian statehood in all of the Oslo Accords. Few people realize that.
Ja hän muistuttaa myöskin siitä, että hyvin harvat oivaltavat sitä, että näissä Oslon rauhansopimuksissa ei ollut mitään mainintaa Palestiinan valtiosta, vaikka hyvin monet uskovat, että niin on. Many people thought that it was, there was some kind of a goal.
There's nothing written down about, you know, which is why we have to remember that when we hear about these three conditions that the quartet placed, you know, on the Hamas government, saying that, you know, you have to recognize Israel, you have to agree to pass peace accords, and you have to relinquish the use of violence. We need to remember, first of all, of course, the conditions are bogus because they're not realizable. But they're also not reciprocal, meaning that Israel on a daily basis, violates all of the agreements, whether it's the Paris protocols that say they have to allow in Palestinian imports, whether it's the Oslo Accords and so forth, you know. But that Oslo doesn't even mention Palestinian statehood. So I think a lot of Palestinians now are starting to rethink this notion of two states and really wanting to advance the notion of one democratic state.
Johan mainitsi sen, että tämä, koska tässä Oslon rauhansopimuksessa ei ollut mitään mainintaa Palestinan valtiosta, niin yhä useammat palestinalaiset itse ovat alkaneet ajatella asiaa toisella tavalla, lähteneet siitä, että tämmöisen kahden valtion ratkaisu. Ideahan on koko ajan ollut se, että on kaksi valtiota, on Israelin valtio ja tuleva Palestinan valtio, ne eläisivät rauhassa keskenään, niin monet palestinalaiset ovat ajatelleet sen sijaan, että pitää perustaa yksi yhteinen valtio. One state where they are, where the Jews and Arabs are.
Exactly, yeah. Like a democratic.
Israelis and Palestinians.
Yes, yeah.
Että ihanteinen ratkaisu on yksi demokraattinen valtio, jossa sekä israelilaiset että palestinalaiset elävät saman valtion sisällä.
Yeah, and sorry to go back to you were asking me about the situation after the war. I give you some statistics. I mean, just to show you how the situation hasn't really improved. I don't always like to rely on statistics because they don't really, you can't quantify kind of the human scale of what's going on, whether the effect, the psychological effect or the trauma, the invasive way that the siege and the occupation, you know, divides families and destroys lives and hope and freedom. But, you know, but just some statistics, I mean some basic things. Yeah,
Leila haluaa kertoa muutamia tilastotietoja. Hän sanoi, että tilastot kyllä usein niin kuin eivät aina todellista kuvaa, semmoista elävää kuvaa siitä, mitä tuntuu elää tuolla ja miten esimerkiksi tämä miehitys eristää perheitä toisistaan ja hajottaa perheitä ja mitä se tuntuu ihmisten arkielämässä. Mutta kuitenkin hän haluaa muutaman tällaisen tilaston esittää. What kind of statistics would you?
So, for example, you know, this is based on reports by a group of NGOs like this month, that the most update statistics, but you know, 70% of the population survives on under $1 a day, and they spend 56 US cents on food every day for their families.
70% this is Gaza.
Yes, in Gaza, yeah.
70% Gazan asukkaista elää vähemmällä kuin dollari päivässä.
Yeah, half of the farmland in Gaza now is out of production or not reachable because of the attacks by Israel. They destroyed the land or because of the buffer zone that they created.
Puolet viljelysmaasta Gazassa on puolta viljelysmaasta ei voida viljellä, koska tämän sodan seurauksena ja kaikkien sen jälkeen aiheuttamien tuhojen vuoksi.
Yeah, previous to this, to the siege, there was about something like, you know, more than 3,000 tons of strawberries and cherry tomatoes that were being exported from Gaza to Europe, and like 500 million carnations, and now there's about 0% exports being allowed out.
Sitä tuotiin ennen tätä piiritystä, niin muun muassa mansikoita ja kukkia Eurooppaan. What kind of, how many tons of strawberries?
What did I say? 3,000 tons.
3,000 tonnia mansikoita and
3,000 tons of cherry tomatoes and strawberries, yeah.
Yeah.
And they grow in the winter there, so it was a very good trade. You know, I personally interviewed many farmers when I was there, and they were doing very well. And of course, all of their livelihoods and the people that they support is completely cut off now.
And that all was before the Oslo?
No, this is before the siege started on Gaza.
In 2004 and
continuous in the 2000s, yeah. There was a lot of European-funded projects to help the farmers and after the disengagement to get the to use the land
after disengagement after 2005 when they
it was roughly around that period in the 2000s like 2002 to 2005
niin 2000-luvun alussa niin siellä oli paljon eurooppalaisten rahoittamia projekteja Gaasassa, jossa muun muassa juuri marjojen ja vihannesten viljelyä ja se on hyvin oli vielä niin kuin ihan suotuisa tilanne sikäli, että näitä voitiin viedä Eurooppaan, koska ne kasvavat Gaasassa talvella.
Yeah. 65% of babies are anemic now. 65% of babies have anemia, iron deficiency anemia. They're malnourished, you know.
65% vauvoista on aliravittuja.
Which is, you know, on par with some of the poorest nations in Africa, which is something that shouldn't be happening in Gaza, because this is a situation, I mean, remember, this isn't a natural disaster. It's not because it's poor. It's because this is a man-made thing. This is the result of the blockade and the siege, you know.
Tämä vastaa tilannetta jossakin kaikkein köyhimmissä Afrikan maissa ja tätä eroa, mutta tämä eroaa siitä, että se on kysymys tämän luonnonoloista, vaan tämä on ihmisen aiheuttama katastrofi.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, my point is that more than the statistics, you know, we have to realize again what the siege does is it prevents basic things. Like on a weekly basis, Israel has a list that it submits of different items that it doesn't allow into Gaza, and they say, oh, it's security based items, but really, if you look at the list, it's hundreds of items, things like toys, musical instruments, crayons, children's books, herbs like coriander and sage, cement, you know, to rebuild. None of the houses or the things that were destroyed have been rebuilt. So very basic things that people use on a daily basis are being denied because of the blockade.
Israel pitää tätä tässä tämän saaron aikana niin on tehnyt listan tuotteista, joita sinne ei saa viedä, ja ne kontrolloivat sitä koko ajan, ja niihin luetellaan tämmöisiin sanotaan vaarallisiin tuotteisiin, kuin lasten leluja ja lyijykyniä ja kaikkea sellaista, mikä jolla kukaan kontrolloi sitä, että mitä tavaroita Gazaan pääsee.
Yeah. Audio.